Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his path-breaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book, just out, is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Thanks very much. Glad to join you.
And in about 15 or 20 minutes or so, the president will be speaking at his State of the Union, but he'll be speaking to a House that's divided, given that half of the room appear to have made a career out of demonizing Obama in ways that are both racist and disrespectful to the office of the presidency. Do you think he should call them out on dog whistle politics?
Well, first of all, I think we should understand how race is being used against him. The public discourse of racism has really shifted in the last 50 years, and it now occurs in code. So that on one level, it doesn't seem to be about race at all. Maybe it's about Muslims or about illegal aliens or about whether President Obama is foreign-born or what his policies are on welfare. And on the other, it's really triggering racial fears, terrorists, foreign-born, Muslim, welfare. All of those are ways to trigger anxiety about what's happening in America and whether minorities are this threatening presence. Now, given that rhetorical evolution, watch what happens. If President Obama were to say, hey, race is being used to scare the American public, to divide you, to make you afraid of me, he would immediately be attacked, and the attack would take this form. First, conservatives would say, what do you mean race? We never said race. We just said Muslim, foreign-born, liar, cheater, and lazy, right? But we never said race. And then they would say, but someone did say race. You did, President Obama. You're the first person to put race into this conversation. You're dividing us by race. You're playing the race card, and you're the real racial bigot. Now, that is just a stock rhetorical routine within conservative racial discourse now. And what's the upshot? The upshot is we get a constant litany of racial innuendo, and at the same time, it's very hard to address it head on because the minute you say, hey, this is race baiting, you get accused of being a racist. So should Obama call out his critics for race baiting? I don't think he can afford to. I think it's just too dangerous for him to do that right now.
So, in other words, his tormentors in the Congress who use race to unite and motivate their dwindling base, there is no way to point that out, even though endless amounts of political scientists have pointed it out.
There's no way for President Obama to point it out, but it's incumbent on members of his administration, on civil rights groups, on foundations, on liberals generally, on the public, you know, as a whole, to really begin to protest this sort of politics. And in this sense, there's something critically important that the Obama administration can do. The Obama administration has been aggressive in telling its allies in unions and foundations and civil rights groups not to talk about race because they don't want the Obama administration embroiled in racial disputes. I think that's a terrible blunder. I don't think Obama ought to address dog whistle politics, but I think he ought to give the green light to others who are close to him to begin to talk about what a destructive force this is in American life, and that's something the administration could and should do.
So given that Congressman Sessions of Texas, apparently at a White House meeting, said to the president, I can't even stand to look at you, and it obviously was behind the scenes it was agreed that that people would sort of forget about it. The president must have had to swallow that one. What is it in this man that gives him this ability to turn the other cheek?
I think temperamentally, President Obama learned the wrong lesson in his life. Temperamentally, he learned the lesson that if you stay above the fray, that you can bring everybody together and that rational discourse alone will lead to a consensus that will allow us all to move forward. That makes sense unless there are huge vested issues at stake. And we have to realize that sort of vision of American politics is completely at odds with what's happened. Over the last 50 years, power over American government has shifted from the people to the corporations to the wealthiest individuals. And in this context, they have a tremendous amount to lose by cooperating with a Democratic administration that wants to use government to start taking care of the middle class again. This isn't going to be about communication. This isn't going to be about consensus building. At the end of the day, this is about power. This is about who controls government and whether government is stacked to favor the very rich or to take care of the rest of us. And that's not going to be something that comes through negotiation. Obama needs to realize that he needs to mobilize his base. He needs to help get liberals elected. He needs to use his bully pulpit to mobilize the electorate. That's the sort of speech that he ought to be engaged in, not this sort of turn the other cheek, compromise, look for consensus with people who are never going to cooperate with him.
Again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his path-breaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book just out is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. So he's apparently going to talk about the growing wealth and income disparity in the United States. And I take it that you feel that there's a direct connection there between the plutocratic power of, the fact that we arguably are no longer a democracy but have become a plutocracy and our economy is a plutonomy. How do dog whistle politics feed and propagate the disparity?
I think there's a very direct connection. We are experiencing levels of wealth inequality that we haven't seen in 100 years. Well, what happened 100 years ago? You had robber barons, you had concentrated wealth, you had a financial collapse, you had the Great Depression. But in the wake of the Great Depression, we realize that that government must organize the economy, government must organize society, and the question is, for whom should it be organized? And we decided that government and the economy should be organized to take care of the middle class, and we understood what was required: routes of upward mobility, a social safety net, investment in infrastructure, and progressive taxation to take money from the very wealthiest in society, to prevent concentrations of wealth, and to distribute it broadly. That was a consensus under which Democrats and Republicans alike governed this country through the 1960s. But with the civil rights movement and with change in terms of racial dynamics, conservatives came to understand that while they could not win by directly attacking New Deal liberalism, they could win if they presented their attacks on New Deal liberalism as instead a repudiation of lazy minorities. And here's the significance of terms like welfare queen that Ronald Reagan used. Ronald Reagan told the story of a welfare queen tooling around in a Cadillac to say to white voters, lazy minorities are ripping you off. They're taking the government's money, which is ultimately your money. We ought to slash the social safety net, yes, but we also ought to cut taxes. And so you get this tax revolution in which whites think that they're cutting taxes to cut off these lazy minorities. But in fact, under the Reagan administration in the 1980s, over $1 trillion in went through these tax cuts to the richest 1% of Americans. And then a further $1 trillion has gone to the richest 1% of Americans because of the Reagan tax cuts every decade thereafter. So if you want to understand what has happened to the country, why the rich are so insanely wealthy now, and why the rest of us are struggling with jobs, are struggling with a housing crisis, are struggling with a government that doesn't seem to take care of us and doesn't seem to invest in infrastructure, the answer is look at the way cultural provocations, and in particular race, have been used to convince a broad segment of the middle class that their real enemy is minorities, when in fact the real enemy is concentrated wealth and the way it's trying to hijack government.
So do you think the president therefore made a mistake when he first came into office agreeing not to point out how much of the treasury was buried into a rat hole in the sands of Iraq and the lives were wasted? And then on top of that, I think, you know, we're talking about maybe $7 trillion have been spent since 9/11 with very little to show for it except disastrous wars. And then on top of that, something like $12 trillion was spent to bail out Wall Street. And you would think that a narrative that could cut across what you're telling us, Ian Haney Lopez, is one that points out how much the working Americans, whether they're black, white, or Latino, have in common.
I think that's exactly right. I think President Obama blundered terribly at the start of his administration. He campaigned on the promise of change, and what you saw is that the American public is hungry for change, hungry for a new, not just for bringing government back onto the side of the middle class, but for a new understanding of what has happened to us over the last 50 years. And I think Obama was in a perfect position because of the different calamities confronting the country in 2008, beginning in 2009. He was in the perfect position to say to the American public, we need to stop being divided by race. We need to stop all this nonsense about minorities being the big threat in our lives. We need to realize the way in which concentrated wealth has hijacked government. We need to bring government back onto the side of the middle class. And if people are going to holler and protest and whine about how this is class warfare, you bet, because we've been in a class warfare for the last 50 years and we've been losing. That was the perfect opportunity to do that. But instead, even in his inaugural address, he pivoted and began to reach out across the aisle, seeking this bipartisan consensus. And in order to do that, he began to use Republican frames. He began to talk about the way in which a bloated federal government was the problem, about how we ought to freeze wages for federal employees, about how taxes were too high. And the minute he seized on the Republican frame, he spelled doom for his own administration, because the Republican frame is fundamentally one that says the problem is that government is run by and for minorities. And now here we have a black president who seems to confirm the very validity of that crazy thesis. So, yes, I think that by the time you get the Tea Party, by the time you get the 2010 elections, yes, it's true. President Obama's hands were tied by Republican intransigence in Washington. But in January of 2009, that history, that future was yet unwritten, and he had a tremendous opportunity to use the crises that have been falling the country to give us a new narrative about what happened, who was to blame, and how we could move forward.
And, of course, when the crash happened and the bailout happened and TARP happened, curiously enough, it was the Democrats who abdicated that issue, and it was picked up. The outrage over Wall Street's bailout was picked up by the Tea Party, of all people, who ended up being shills for the plutocrats. So therein is the tragedy of leaving that whole narrative off the table. But given that where we stand today and the president's future hangs in the balance here in this election year of 2014, and the polls don't indicate particularly optimistic picture that the Democrats could lose the Senate and continue to lose or even lose the House by more, and that would make him a lame duck. So at what point will he have skin in the game? Rather than be an early lame duck, why not come out fighting this year and try and get the turnout? Because the turnout's what it's all about. You know, in 2010, only 75 million voted after 145 million had voted a couple of years earlier to sweep the Democrats in.
I completely agree. I think that there remains an opportunity for President Obama to provide a new narrative about what has happened to the country and why. And I'm really glad you mentioned the Tea Party. We should be very clear. Tea Partiers, they hate President Obama. But this is not to say they're bad people. This is not to say they're racist. We need to be absolutely clear. Tea Partiers are Americans who are hurting. At the grassroots level, these are people who are seeing jobs go away, who are seeing retirement pensions go away, who are worried about the future, their own future. They're worried about their children, and they really want to understand what happened to the America in which if you worked hard and played by the rules, you got ahead and you could be assured of a better future for your children. These are the people that Obama ought to be talking to, and what he ought to be telling them is, you won't find a solution in all of this panic about minorities. You won't find new jobs. You won't find investment in infrastructure. You won't find a social safety net in all this hysteria about minorities. You need instead to think about the way in which our government has been taken over and been hijacked. But I think it's very important for all of us to understand there's a real hunger in the United States, in the population as a whole, to understand what happened to us. And this story about how the country is being destroyed by minorities, a lot of people understand it's just bunk. They don't accept it, but they need to be offered something else, and it's up to President Obama to begin telling that story, and also and up to the rest of us, I'd say.
Well, I think, Ian Haney-Lopez, the what's happening now with Obamacare and has happened with the Affordable Care Act since it started, it's been, you know, under attack remorselessly by the Republicans. And again, the dog whistle coded racial appeals in the opposition to Obamacare is that essentially your premiums are going to go up just to take a bunch of freeloaders off the streets and give them free health care. And is there any chance that that can be turned around in time before October? Is there any chance that the evidence that, in other words, are all boats going to rise with Obamacare?
I think that there is a chance. I don't think it's a, I don't think this is about Obamacare in particular. I think this is about whether government is fundamentally on the side of the American people or is fundamentally a threat to them because it's been hijacked by minorities. Those are the two stories that are out there. And now, crazy as it may seem, a majority of whites seem to subscribe to the idea that government's the biggest threat in their lives because it's been hijacked by minorities. I think it's incredibly important for people to get out and say government is necessary, government for the middle class, government concerned with the fate of all of us, government investing in the country and protecting people from the predations of great wealth is incredibly important to all of us. And if what's getting in the way of good government is all of this rhetoric of racial division, we need to say no more. We refuse to be bamboozled by these claims that government is just giving away the store to minorities. We understand that government needs to work for everybody. That's the story that President Obama needs to tell. Can he tell that story in a coherent, convincing way, in a way that reaches everybody by October of this year? Maybe, maybe not. But he has to start, because in starting, he'll lay the groundwork for other politicians at the presidential level, but also at the state level, to tell the same story and to begin to weave this new narrative. And I should say, I say new narrative, this is really an old narrative. This is the old New Deal narrative with this difference. The New Deal had a critical flaw built into it in the sense that the New Deal, because it required the cooperation of the Southern Democrats, was racially restrictive. This is the old New Deal, FDR, Second Bill of Rights narrative, but now unencumbered by racial divisions.
But of course, the difference was that FDR, when he was attacked in this poisonous way that Obama is being attacked, and largely by the plutocrats, he said, "I welcome their hatred." He really took them on. Is it because Obama is a black man? He doesn't want to come across as an angry black man?
I think that Obama's blackness increases the risk of him being understood as inappropriately angry, as dangerously angry. I definitely think that there's that element. But I don't think that's the bulk of it. I think the bulk of it is temperamental. I think President Obama fundamentally misunderstands or has misunderstood the situation, has misunderstood the way in which the interests of the very rich are ranged against us. But I do think that he needs to look at FDR for a model. We will not change our narrative. We will not change our politics simply through a positive message of we're all in this together, let's pull together and work together. Mm-hmm. We need a sense of who's to blame, who's been doing this, and who's been getting rich while we've been getting poor. Well, and that's where FDR understood. People had to have a sense that there were people out there who didn't have their best interests at heart, who were bad for the public generally. Mm-hmm. And I think FDR was right to welcome their animosity, and we'll need that sort of politics again.
Well, Ian Haney-Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciated the conversation.
Again, I've been speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. He is an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his path-breaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book just out is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at Ian IanMasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.